Good morning, church, and thank you, Pastor Chris, for the kind words of introduction. I have always wondered why I didn't go to sociology first, but to theology first. And having studied both theology and sociology at the postgraduate level, I think God had a plan. Most people go to a secular study and work and then come to the church, but mine was reversed. I think in sociology, I might have ended up as a Marxist, but because I started with theology, I have a theistic overview, and Pastor rightly pointed that the worldview and the teaching and the ideas on public policy and the way the world should be is actually driven from a God-centered perspective to creation, to the earth, to the role. Now, our church has been, and the pastors have been preaching and teaching us on the book of Joshua, and these are narrative passages, and most often narrative passages are interpreted in application in a spiritual way to the congregation, because narrative passages or the historical passages of the Old Testament, like Joshua or the Kings and so forth, were actual historical events. They are not myth, they are not stories, but they are actual history and events that can be rechecked in both in history as well as from the archaeological findings. So the salvation history and the stories that we read of actually took place, and they are not myth and so forth. And so in this story, we read of the land, and I'm going to look largely at a more literal interpretation of the text and apply it to us, but there is also spiritual meaning and reference. Now, it's amazing that I have been asked and a passage given to me that then has this theme, give me my mountain. It's not my mountain, but this is not in Palestine, but this is in Kudat, in Sabah. And I will tell you about this mountain and the villages that are making this their inheritance. And as we remember Malaysia Day, it is not just about Peninsula Malaysia, because for most of us on this side, we are very peninsula-centric. But we need to look on Malaysia Day at Sabah and Sarawak, and that we are not Malayans, we are Malaysians. And so the whole focus and application would be to land and the indigenous community. But because these indigenous people are fellow Malaysians and they're also brothers and sisters in the Lord, it has tremendous relevance to us. Now, in this passage that was read to us, Joshua chapter 14, verse 6 to 15, the context brings out some key themes. Context of Malaysia Day and its application, but as you note on in Joshua 14:2, it's actually land allocation to the tribes of Israel. Land and its allocation, it's in the context of the promised land, because the promised land is a very important dimension of salvation history. Because the people left Egypt, they were in the wilderness, and we will reflect on that. But eventually, under Joshua, they inherit this land. And the wilderness experience, their experience before that of slavery, and then moving into this land flowing with milk and honey, is actually God's promise to his people. Now, in reading this passage, I am able to draw three key points. The outline of my talk is available in the program. There is no fill in the blanks for you today. Easier. Just listen to me. Don't fall asleep. And so if we look at it, it's the theme of inheritance, Caleb's claim. Can we go to the next slide, please? Inheritance, Caleb's claim, and Hebron are three themes that are drawing on, and we will then look at its relevance. When we take the term inheritance, most of us would have, when our parents passed away, could have inherited something, money, land, or house, or those of us who have passed the 60 or 65 year, we are always thinking of what inheritance would we leave behind for our children or grandchildren, or whether there is anything to be left behind. Now, in the context of the promised land, it is a promise that was made actually to Abraham. And if we turn in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, we read of the call that God gave. But at the same time in Genesis 12, 2, I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you, was God's blessing to Abraham at the call. And in verse 7 of Genesis 12, the Lord says, to your offspring, I give this land. It's a promise from God, the creator, the sustainer of the world. Where all the resources are available to God, he pledged to Abraham and his offspring that land. And basically then, it's a literal taking the land. They had to go with swords. They had to be equipped. They went in. And we know of the story, and I will highlight the story of that 40 over years before they actually occupy the promised land. But it's a move to that land. Now, inheritance can be seen firstly in a literal sense of possession of the land, but inheritance can also be viewed in a spiritual term, in a spiritual sense. And if we look at Romans chapter 12, chapter 4, verse 13, and then verse 16, we get this understanding of the spiritual sense of it. And Paul writes in Romans 4:13. It was not through the law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise that he would be heir of the world, but through the righteousness that comes by faith. It's not because he's the son in a literal sense, but it was through righteousness and faith that is applied. And in verse 16 of the same chapter, therefore, the promise comes by faith, so that it may be by grace and may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring. Now, in a sense, those of us in Christ are making that claim that we too are claiming the promises that were made, because we too are Abraham's offspring by faith and righteousness, not only to those who are of the law, that means the Jewish community, those then under the Old Testament, but also to those who have the faith of Abraham, have the faith of Abraham. And there it goes on to say, a father of many nations. So the land and inheritance and the promises are given to us as well by faith. And ultimately, we are not just looking at a piece of land. We are looking at the new Jerusalem, the new kingdom, God's heaven, in which we would inherit and have a place in it. But in this particular passage in Joshua and Caleb's story and claiming the hill country or the mountain, it's actually possessing the land. And Psalms chapter 37, verse 29, the righteous shall inherit the land and dwell upon it forever. Or in Joshua chapter 1 verse 6, be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. So therefore, inheritance is an important theme in a literal understanding of possessing the promised land, likewise in a spiritual sense, the land as well. But I want to apply that inheritance to indigenous people and their land and their rights. Because indigenous people have customary rights and ownership of the land, but they were dispossessed. We received independence, but the Orang Aslis, in one sense of the peninsula, became dispossessed of the land because they didn't have land titles. They were unlike Chettiars in KL, who actually owned land titles or Chinese business or Malay native and customary land. They had rights to the land. But indigenous people, those especially who were nomadic, who were hunters, gatherers, who were in shifting cultivation, occupied the land. They knew the land. They knew where their grandfather hunted a wild boar or killed a tiger or where the elephant attacked them. They knew stories. They knew the lakes. They knew the rivers. They would name every mountaintop. They had a story to the forest, but they had no legal title. And at independence on 31st August, all land became state land, whether by state governments and in the context of Malaysia, then Sabah and Sarawak likewise, state governments took possession of the land. And if you had land title, if you had the right of having farmed it, then you can make a defense. If not, you will have to go to court and make a claim and then show that you have fruit trees, you have burial ground, that you were customarily in possession of this land. And there are different land laws and rights to complicate this. But inheritance, it's their inheritance, it's their land, and it's an important theme to look at this. We might think, what the big deal, you know, it's just a land. And if we reflect on the struggles of the Palestinian and Jewish community, it's for that strip of land. If you reflect of Sri Lanka and the ethnic conflict, it was also for land. And throughout world history and even now, there is so much of contestation over land because land links to identity, land links to prosperity, land links to the development of the people and their place. The Rohingyas have no place in Myanmar because the Myanmarist government is not recognizing them as being part of the land. So there is contestation. And so as Christians, as we reflect on this theme, we can apply this. Now, the next theme that comes is this story of this great old man at 85. You know, when you cross your age 60, like me, I've come into 62, you're always thinking, how long more? What does God want you to do, you know, 62? Can I survive 85? Caleb is saying he's ready for battle at 85. Can I be able to pick up, other than the walking stick, at 85? But to then reflect back on the claims of this man. And the passage that we read together in Joshua chapter 14, verse 7, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me out. And then he says, I am now 85 years old. I was ready for battle at 40. I am ready at 85 to go to battle, to take possession of the land. And in between is this fascinating story of spies being sent out. You know, espionage work is not new, you know. Secret service, infiltration, is as old as the Bible is. And here you have the story of two sets of spies going. I reread the story. It's really fascinating because the first set of the spies going was under Moses in Numbers chapter 13 and 14. Spies went. The commissioning leader was Moses. Each tribe sent a spy because they were participatory. It was collective leadership. Each was to occupy the land. And so each tribe had to send like a wakil, you know. So one person has to go out in the team. And in the team, in Numbers 13:6, Caleb was coming from the tribe of Judah, and Joshua, who had another name at that point and was later named by Moses, were two of the 12 that went out. Now, they had a mission, and they were commissioned to do something. This is like a research project, you know. You are now sending a fact-finding team into another land. It is not an overt, it's a covert operation that no one should know what you are doing. It's a bit of a James Bond type of action. In Numbers 13, see what the land is, if the people are strong or weak, if they are few or many, what kind of land, is it good, it is bad, what kind of soil, is it fertile, is it poor, is the town well-walled or fortified, bring back evidence. So the evidence was the grapes that they brought back. You know? So this was the commission, Mission Impossible sort of commission. 12 guys went in, and then they had to report of that event. And the story is interesting because in the report, there is the positive side of the report. Yes, the land is flowing with milk and honey. The cities are powerful, well-fortified, and so forth. But there was two interpretations of the event. Caleb had one. Majority of the spies had another. They said in the Numbers passage, because they were descendants of Anna, a word used there, that they were giants, and we looked like grasshoppers to them. And fear filled the people to such an extent that there was a rebellion and God had to intervene. There was judgment, and as a result, none of them will see the promised land. For 40 years, they will become children of the wilderness. They were first children of slavery in Egypt. They become children of the wilderness. And then judgment came, but Caleb stood up and he then said that we can take it, because Caleb had a positive outlook. He saw the problem, he saw the giants, he saw the people, but he said, God is with us. We can take the land even now with the resources that we had. But the people were too afraid, and God's judgment came upon them. The second set of spies went in Joshua chapter 2, verses 1 to 24. The commissioning leader is Joshua. This time he didn't send 12 people. He sent only 2 people. So I couldn't work out why just 2. Maybe he thought that maybe 2 is better than 12 because 2 had a positive report. Now, the mission in Joshua chapter 2 is go look over the land, especially Jericho. But the method utilized is very strange because these 2 guys, they are not named, actually go to a prostitute's house. And I'm trying to work that out because they were not ashamed to tell it when they came back. Whether the prostitute's house was a safe place to go, or they knew that she was a sympathizer, or whether in a prostitute's house it was possible to get all the stories, because the rest of it doesn't say, but they then have a report, And the report is that the people were fearful of the Jews this time. After 40 years, this is what Rahab said. I know that the Lord has given you this land, that a great fear of you has fallen on us, that all our lives in this country are melting in fear because of you and your God. Actually, it's very interesting that the first generation that went to the promised land, I would say, were quite fearful because they were under slavery. And God put the people through 40 years of wilderness. Imagine living in a wilderness for 40 years. You will really toughen up because there will be snakes, there you have to fend for yourself. It's not a sheltered protection. And they had to fight through that period, and they had to undergo the spiritual discipleship and confidence building, and they then become the children of wilderness who now have instilled fear, and the people fear them. And that's why Caleb says, at 85, I can go out and be victorious as I was. Now, to me, this is an exercise of faith, and it's also a lesson for legacy. It's beyond inheritance. It's legacy now. At 85, or even at 60, or 55 and above, what is the legacy we are leaving behind? What is it that can sum total our life? Is it the career that we have had? Is it the house? Is it the car? Is it the material possessions that we have? What defines us? And at this critical period, if you're 55, 60, what is it that will lead you on? If God gives us another 10 years, another 20 years, would we be like Caleb who says, I have lived with the Lord, I've waited for the promised fulfillment, and I'm still strong and courageous, full of rigor to go and take it up. I see ourselves not as children of slavery or children of the wilderness. We are all children of prosperity. As children of prosperity, we play it safe. We are not risk takers. We are comfortable. We will chabot if it's too much of a problem. That's children of prosperity. We are not hunters-gatherers in the old sense of the word, like indigenous orang asli people, but we are also hunters and gatherers because we go to the supermarket and hunt for the best cheap price, take it up, but you have to have a credit card, not an axe or a parang to fight for the meat or the item. So children of prosperity in faith, what then is the legacy that we leave behind in Malaysia that is struggling and the indigenous people in the context of their land? Now, we'll move on Hebron. You can read it in your notes. But reflecting on Caleb, reflecting on the experiences of the people, reflecting on the inheritance, let us look at its application now. Because application is as important, whether you take this passage as only referring to promised land, that I'm looking towards heaven, I'm looking towards the new Jerusalem. But while on earth, we still have a role and play to this community. The Christian community in Malaysia is something people on the KL, peninsula-centric side, often fail to realize, that more than 60% of Christians in Malaysia are in Sabah and Sarawak. They are indigenous people, they are Bahasa speaking, and basically poor compared to the churches and Christians on the peninsula side. And indigenous people across Sabah, Sarawak, and the peninsula are struggling with their land rights. So if we take this passage, is God has God given this land to indigenous people or not, who were rightfully in the forest or occupants of the land, but who are dispossessed due to lack of political power and organizing, inability because they don't have big money, because they are not as educated, and all they might have is bows and arrows or poisonous dart. They are powerless before the state, before politicians, before rich and powerful businesses that have taken and occupy their lands for economic growth and other development. So in a sense, to some of the indigenous people, they feel like grasshoppers in the presence of those who might be so-called Ana, or giants of the land. I want to draw three examples and then some application. In the context of application, I came across the story of Dr. Paul Porodong in Bukit Gumatong Sabah in Kudat. I met him at the Sabah Theological Seminary. This was after I was asked to preach on this theme, Give Me My Mountain. He told me the story of this bukit. It's actually an actual place in Kudat, and I did visit it. And at the foothills of this hill, which is a forest, it's a forest reserve, there are 13 Runus Christian villages. All these villages have churches, they have pastors, there's a Bible school at the foot of the hill that requires a lot of assistance. But the Sabah Forestry Department, for the first time, has handed the forest to the villagers to manage the forest. This is an amazing story. They don't have land rights, but they will have rights to the land. They formed a committee of the 13 villages, not 12 tribes, but 13 villages that are there. And Paul Porodong, whom I met, he is an environmental anthropologist. He has written, if you Google his name, they got a Facebook account of this mountain and the ecotourism. They also have some publications on this that is in international journals. But conservation or community-based conservation is a very important concept that has been developed, where the forest is handed back to forest-based communities. They might not have legal rights, but they have rights to the use of the land, to the timber. So the community or village manages it. They do all kinds of activities to generate income and organize it and draw from it. Nepal has some outstanding examples, and if you Google the term forest-based communities, you will get this impact. So here we are looking at Paul Porodong and his church and the mountain and the work that they are doing, and it's largely from the Christian community. And that's one good example of public policy, and we could actually call for greater use of public policy. The second is actually the land inquiry report. There's an exhibition out there. There are two big posters on the land inquiry. In 2013, a land inquiry report was done, 18 specific recommendations. There were 892 complaints of violations of land that was recorded. Government set up a task force, government has set up a cabinet committee, but none of these issues have been addressed. Of the recommendations, the key was the setting up of a tribunal to inquire into the land rights and an Indigenous Peoples Commission. Both of this has not really taken place. So we need to pray that people came forth, an independent human rights commission set up by the government has written an excellent report that is available at the exhibition booth, or you can Google for it. But unfortunately, good reports need public action to resolve it. 892 statements recorded of infringement into indigenous people's rights. So that's a major issue. Now, the third application that is taking place is an organic farm in Ulu Gumum, Pahang. Now, for this story, I managed to invite the man on the photo, and let's give a hand to Con Onsen. Onsen's wife, Dr. Sokwa, and their two daughters are here. Can you wave wherever you are, where they're in?
They are around somewhere.
Okay.
I couldn't find them.
Okay, we can't find them. But Onsen, tell me, why as a British-trained lawyer with an exciting career, because you did your chambering under Karpal Singh, although you don't look anywhere near him, why did you become a community development worker?
I started off as a young lawyer, being involved in legal aid, helping the Orang Aslis. But in 1992, when I visited a Orang Asli Jakun village in Pahang, I had never seen such extreme poverty in modern Malaysia. I mean, these Orang Aslis were living in thatched houses with discarded zinc sheets. Their drinking water source was a hole in the ground 3-4 feet and highly contaminated. And I knew I had to go beyond just the law and find a way to help. And that's how my approach changed.
Now, Onsen, tell us which church you go to, because we have been trying to get you to join DUMC. But, you know, when he came back from England, we said, Onsen, this is the right place. You know, come join us. But he believes in a small community church. Yes, please tell us.
Yes. Datuk Dennison has been trying to offer me dual citizenship. I was wondering whether that's possible in churches. I'm very, very inspired and encouraged by what you all do. But I think I have to play my little role, that's all.
Okay. Worship's in...
I worship at EFC Cheras, a small church of 100 strong.
Now, Onsen, tell us something about the Ulu Gumum project, because now you have become a farmer, organic farm, and when I met your wife and daughters, they're all busy packing like Pasar Malam style sale.
Yes, yeah.
Tell us about what impact it's making on the lives of these people.
Yes, we started a 2.5 eco farm, helping them plant organic vegetables. It has the potential of tripling their income. But it's so important to not just help them plan, but also to develop a marketing arm which links them directly to the market. For example, during the Cempadak harvest season, they would be paid maybe RM1 for per kilo of the fruit, and by the time it gets to Tesco, it goes at RM6. But during the peak of the harvest, and under the name of glut, they get 20 cents per kilo. And in this approach, we saw they would forever remain at the bottom of the pyramid unless we begin to create a marketing arm which gave them a fair price. And so now with this, we can, by creating OA Organics, we link them directly from farm to the end consumer, and we can triple their income pretty easily.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, I think it's an amazing story where you are trying to have a mindset change, capacity building, more productive use of land that's remaining idle, from hunters, gatherers, to farmers. And actually, the next picture shows actually that was the first fruits. And these are all the people who are doing the farming on a daily basis. It's an amazing story. And you can be part of similar such stories. You might have a business interest, or you might have a cooking interest, or you might want to just purchase. But this is something that we can move idle land into productive land and assist people during that time. And there are amazing stories like Paul Porudong and others as well. Now, I think in conclusion, we have a role to pray. For this situation, because the land rights struggles can be a major area of conflict. It requires prayer. It requires us to have the right information of the people in Sabah, in Sarawak, The indigenous people, like Ulugumum, is in the Pekan area in Pahang. It's largely among the Jakun tribe, and there are changes that are taking place. So we need to pray, and our church has that strength in prayer. Now, secondly, we can also volunteer our time. And you might think, look, I can't go out so far, or we have 101 excuses. We might think age is a problem. Think of Caleb at 85. He was willing to go to the battlefield. So we can be volunteers in social or public policy advocacy or in any way. I'd like to call up two people from our church who are very active using their professional, Aimi Liu and Fun Fung. Let's give them a hand. Now, they need no convincing to be part of DUMC. Aimi and Fun Fung are part. Aimi is active in the Jubilee, and Fun Fung and CNBN. Aimi, what has made, what drew you to Orang Asli issues?
Well, when our cell group first visited and volunteered to help in the Orang Asli village in Johor, and when the whole group of us went in, and as On San said just now, when we see the poverty, and we see, for my view as a lawyer, we see the way that they are being bullied by the authorities and how fearful they are, and seeing their land taken away, that created a burden on me to try to help as a lawyer in any way that I could.
Okay. Fun Fung, yourself, in your capacity?
Yes, I'm basically a health writer, but you know, through my work and contact with people and seeing what's happening on the ground, I see that the indigenous people are the most marginalized and they are always being disregarded. So because of that, I just feel that I want to write more about them. So that was how I do that in my writing. And they are usually like cases like, all the stories are the same. Everywhere you go, a lot of villages are like that. The scene is like this. One day they will wake up and find that suddenly there are tractors all around, you know, and the land will be just cut down, slash everything down, down. They're logging, taken out, you know, the loggers will take out the logs. And then after a while, suddenly another person will buy over the land and then, you know, develop it into a rubber plantation or whatever plantation, oil palm or whatever. So they lose their source of food and water and all that, and they become very malnourished. And they just can go into the deeper into the jungle, but they can hardly find food.
Yeah.
So they basically suffer from starvation and malnourishment, and
This is amazing example of two people from our church using the gifts that God's given them, legal training, expertise, and journalism, and they're using. Let me ask you another question to both of you. That is, how is your faith impacting this work? Is your faith guiding you? Is your faith encouraging you? What is faith? What has faith got to do with, you know, or its impact? Okay.
Well, for me, it's an uphill battle because we are really fighting in courts against people who, the authorities, who've got power, who've got money. My faith helps me to persevere. Knowing, I claim for myself the verse in Amos 5:24 that justice will run down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. And that's what I cling on to, even though we have victories, but most of the time we're on the losing end. And we
Praise
know
God.
That one day there'll be justice done for these indigenous people.
Very good.
Okay, for me, I've been writing and writing and writing, and sometimes like you don't see any breakthrough. But I think the Lord calls us to be faithful and just continue, to be persistent, you know. There are days, I feel like, no need to write anymore, Everybody knows already, you know. But I think the Lord says we must continue to speak up for them. I just want to quickly read this Proverbs 31, verses 8 to 9. Speak up for those who cannot speak up for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly, defend the rights of the poor and needy. I think this is our guiding principle in our life.
Thank you. Let's give them a hand. Now, it's quite interesting that Joshua sent two male spies into the promised land. DUMC has sent two young ladies into the land to do good. So maybe the young men should wake up and join us as well in this process. And it's important that we not only pray, not only give voluntary time, like in the case of what Onsen and others are doing, it's actually social investment. So people can actually contribute like grants or donations, but others are actually investing into a business, but wanting certain returns in a particular way, and then encouraging and developing the potential of the land, because there is enormous land. And if these people don't develop the land, then somebody else is coming to take it. So there are poor churches, there are poor Christians around, whether in Sabah, in Sarawak, developing a business plan, helping them, would likewise help finance them and uplift the community. And in so doing, they will have a better quality of life. So the land links to their social well-being, because they will just not remain in that situation. So indigenous people in many parts of the world, whether it's Australia, New Zealand, Canada, even the USA, have lost their lands and their rights to their lands. And so it's important for us to pray, to invest some time. So this Malaysia Day, and if you pray and ask God to see, think of a legacy that you want to leave behind. You might think of a whole village, you could think of a family, you could think of one individual person. If you are in your 40s, think of a baby that you will help support and pray for the next 20 years. Because if you're 40, definitely you'll make it to 60 or 75. As a family, invest into the lives of people. Work with the mission team, work with the CNBN. You can also participate in the land rights workshop, which is coming up. There's a handbill, there is a write-up, the poster. We got Pastor Chris, Pastor Margaret, we got Remy Bulan, the professor, and then we have these three people who you saw them up here, but they will give a fuller thing, and the handsome man on the side will moderate the session. So that will be interesting as well. So sign up. I heard after yesterday's announcement about 20 people signed up, so maybe more will sign up as well in that process. So do take time. Now, it's important as we close for us to not forget Caleb and his stand. So when God gave him a mission, he went as a spy, he brought a report back, and he came with confidence. Even if the land was full of giants, he saw God as a big, almighty, powerful God. He had to wait 45 years for the realization of that promise. But he waited because of faith, because of patience, because of perseverance. I think we need to be careful that we don't lose the time of God. God sometimes gives us an opportunity. There is an opening, and we might have to take the leap of faith. We can be gripped in fear because it's difficult to move out of the prosperity zone to the wilderness. But for Caleb, whether it was in slavery, whether it was in wilderness, or in whatever experience, he had the trust and confidence in God. He did not melt in fear because of the awesome task, but he knew that God gave him that opportunity. You might be 20 today, you might be 40, or you might be in the 60s like me, or you might be much older than me. What's our legacy? What is God telling us in the context of Joshua's passage, in the context of the struggles of indigenous brothers and sisters? Can we do something? Pray, volunteer, invest some money, go out there on a regular basis. What is God speaking to us? And I call Pastor Chris to close us in prayer.